All right. Good afternoon to everyone. I see we have a couple of participants joining now, but we're right at the hour, and we have actually a lot of content to share. So I'd like to welcome everyone to this webinar on multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children associated with COVID-19. This webinar is being brought to you by the Massachusetts Region 1 Regional Disaster Health Response System in collaboration with ASPR. My name is Paul Bittinger. I'm an emergency physician at Mass General Hospital in Boston, and I am the principal investigator and medical director for the Massachusetts Region 1 RDHRS. The Regional Disaster Health Response System is one of two pilot grants funded by the federal government by the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response as a collaboration among hospitals, public health departments, and other key partners to improve overall healthcare disaster response in New England. Very excited to have you join. We have an amazing list of speakers and a lot of content to get through. So I'm going to ask Gary Kleinman, who is the Regional Administrator for Region 1 New England for ASPR, to say some welcoming remarks, and then we'll get right to our speakers. Gary?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me, Paul?
Yes, thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I'll be very brief, but on behalf of ASPR Region 1, my colleague, the FEMA Regional Administrator, Russ Webster, and our counterparts at FEMA Region 1, with whom we've been now operating for over 80 days, I want to welcome you all to this webinar. We are incredibly fortunate to have a partnership with the Partnership for Regional Disaster Health Response. They are able to provide unparalleled subject matter expertise and access to the subject matter experts in a variety of topics from healthcare operations to specialty care. And we're welcoming today to the webinar all of our New England partners representing clinicians of all stripes, hospitals, healthcare coalitions, emergency managers, my colleagues from the HHS operational and staff divisions, corporate partners from other ASPR regions, and our own headquarters. So the panel today is going to be providing a lot of useful information on early recognition and management of MISC and discuss the public health reporting of these cases. I will stop and get out of the way to allow that content to flow. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so very much, Gary. I'm going to introduce our panel as a group now just so that they can flow together from slide to slide. We're really excited to have such a talented group of clinicians joining us. We have Dr. Joanne Chu, who is a pediatric cardiology specialist at the Mass General Hospital for Children, an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, and an assistant professor of pediatrics at the MGH Hospital for Children. Dr. Anne Marie Murray, who is a pediatric infectious disease specialist. She is also a primary care pediatrician at the Mass General Hospital for Children. She's an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and an assistant professor of pediatrics at Mass General Hospital for Children. Dr. Jane Neuberger is a pediatric cardiology specialist at Boston Children's Hospital. She is the Commonwealth Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and is Associate Chief for Academic Affairs at Boston Children's Hospital. Dr. Holly Rothermel is the Clinical Director for Pediatric Rheumatology and is a primary care pediatrician at the Mass General Hospital for Children and is an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Lastly, Dr. Manuela Lahoud-Rum is a pediatric cardiology and critical care specialist at Mass General Hospital for Children. She is an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and assistant professor of pediatrics at Mass General Hospital for Children. So thank you to all of you for joining us. And Dr. Chu, we'll start with you.
Great. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the introduction, Dr. Bittinger. So in the next 10 minutes or so, I will provide a brief overview of the condition with released case definitions and a review of the current literature of multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, MISC. Next slide, please. All right, so looking back at the timeline for how the recognition and understanding of MISC developed in the past few months, on April 22nd, we had our first case of MISC at MGH. On April 26th, the Royal College of Pediatrics and Child Health issued an advisory regarding this unusual hyperinflammatory condition with Kawasaki-like features. On May 2nd, the Pediatric Cardiac Intensive Care Society hosted a webinar with European physicians and other experts in the field sharing their experience thus far. On May 6th, the first report on this condition was published in Lancet with a series of 8 children, which we will review. May 13th, the second report was published by a group from Italy in Lancet as well. And the New York State Department of Health issued an advisory and case definition. May 14th, the CDC turned the syndrome, MISC, with a case definition. On the same day, the Massachusetts DPH also issued an advisory with a reporting structure. And on May 15th, the WHO released an advisory on MISC with a slightly varied case definition, which we will review. Next slide, please. So as you can see here, throughout the past month, there have been alarming headlines in the media, also with a confusing twist of what are we actually calling this, with a presentation referred to as PMIS to PIMS and now MISC. Next slide, please. So we will review here the very first case definition to be officially released by the Royal College of Pediatrics and Child Health following the internal advisory that was issued among regional hospitals 5 days prior. So they defined this as a child presenting with persistent fever, inflammation, and evidence of single or multi-organ dysfunction, and it may include children fulfilling full or partial criteria for Kawasaki disease. There's also exclusion of any other microbial cause, and the SARS-CoV-2 PCR testing may be positive or negative. Next slide, please. So the CDC advisory came out on May 14th, and their case definition was an individual less than 21 years of age, presenting with a fever at least 38 degrees Celsius for at least 24 hours, or reporting of subjective fever at least 24 hours. And evidence of clinically severe illness requiring hospitalization with involvement of at least 2 organ systems, no alternative plausible diagnosis, and positive for current or recent COVID-19 infection by PCR, serology, or antigen test, or COVID-19 exposure within the 4 weeks prior to the onset of symptoms. So in comparison to the UK definition, the CDC now added 1 day of fever, 30 degrees or greater, or subjective, at least 2 organ systems were involved, and also they further define the relationship to the SARS-CoV-2 infection. Next slide, please. So the WHO criteria, which was released a day later on May 15th, it further limited the case definition to children ages 0 to 19, at least 3 days of fever versus 24 hours of fever, and it more specifically defines the organ involvement that would qualify with still at least 2 as per the CDC. And this case definition maintains the same level of evidence of COVID-19 infection, but without a time frame for the likely contact. Next slide, please. So a group in UK published in Lancet on May 6th a correspondence piece titled Hyperinflammatory Shock in Children During COVID-19 Pandemic. So they described 8 patients presenting with hyperinflammatory syndrome, ages 6 to 14 years, 62.5% were male, 75% were of Afro-Caribbean descent, 87.5% were above the 75th percentile for weight, and all were initially PCR negative, with 2 later being positive post-discharge. Next slide, please. So displayed here are the patient characteristics, the clinical presentation, the course, and the outcome of the 8 patients that were described in the series. Next slide, please. So most were without respiratory symptoms. All of these patients progressed to vasoplegic or warm shock requiring pressor support. There was 1 patient that escalated care to ECMO and expired, unfortunately, from a large cerebrovascular infarct. All the patients received IVIG and all were discharged from the ICU in 4 to 6 days. Next slide, please. So an Italian group published a report comparing the Kawasaki-like patients before and during the COVID-19 pandemic. They found that there was a 30-fold increased incidence of Kawasaki-like disease during March and April. And they also found that patients were older, with a higher rate of cardiac involvement, features of macrophage activating syndrome, and a severe form of Kawasaki disease. Next slide, please. So the following were found to be statistically significant. In the more recent Kawasaki-like disease group, there was older age, average age of onset, increased incidence, elevated CRP, leukopenia with a neutrophilic predominance and lymphopenia, thrombocytopenia, hyponatremia, and elevated ferritin levels. The Kobayashi score is a clinical prediction model identifying patients that are at high risk of IVIG resistance. And in this more recent Kawasaki-like disease group, a greater number of patients had a score of at least 5, met criteria for macrophage activating syndrome, Kawasaki disease shock syndrome, had abnormal echocardiograms, and also received adjunctive steroid treatment. Next slide, please. And finally, a group from France and Switzerland published a study in Circulation on May 17th. This was titled Acute Heart Failure is Multisystem Inflammatory Syndrome in Children in the Context of SARS-CoV-2. They described 35 patients from 14 centers that were admitted to ICUs for cardiogenic shock, left ventricular dysfunction, and severe inflammatory state. Their median age was 10 years of age. 88% were positive by PCR or serology. 28% of the patients had comorbidities, including asthma and being overweight. All the patients received IVIG, with a third additionally receiving steroids. 80% required inotropic support, 28% required ECMO, and there were no mortalities. And again, keeping in mind that these were patients that were admitted to the ICU in cardiogenic shock. Next slide, please. And here's a diagram outlining the clinical descriptions of their patients. 89% have bulbar conjunctivitis, 54% with red and cracked lips, 60% with cervical and mesenteric lymphadenopathy, 57% with skin rash. And in terms of the respiratory signs, only 34% were showing respiratory symptoms. LV dysfunction was present in 100% of the patients, with 60% in shock and 28% in via ECMO. Again, keeping in mind the inclusion criteria for the patients they studied. 17% had coronary dilation, 8% had pericarditis, and notably, 83% of these patients had GI involvement with nausea and diarrhea, with two of these patients having such severe presentation of GI symptoms that they underwent exploratory laparoscopy. So this concludes our review of the case definition and the current literature of MISC. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to present an infectious disease perspective today. I would like to start with a brief discussion of SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is currently thought to be the likely trigger for this emerging multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. This is an enveloped, non-segmented, positive sense RNA virus. The spike protein mediates virus binding and uses the ACE2 receptor for entry into human cells. It's a novel beta coronavirus in the same subgenus as the SARS-CoV-1 virus, which caused an epidemic affecting 26 countries and resulted in more than 8,000 cases in 2003. SARS-CoV-2 is more transmissible person to person compared to SARS-CoV-1, and there are now over 5.7 million confirmed cases of SARS-CoV-2 infection worldwide. The mechanisms by which SARS-CoV-2 virus triggers MISC are currently unknown. Next slide, please. The diagnosis of SARS-CoV-2 infection is made by direct detection of viral RNA by nucleic acid amplification tests, most frequently reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction, or RT-PCR. Different RT-PCR assays amplify and detect different regions of the SARS-CoV-2 genome, and most target at least two genes. Common genes detected with RT-PCR include the nucleocapsid gene, the envelope gene, the spike gene, and the gene encoding for RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. Next slide, please. All patients with suspected MISC should be tested for SARS-CoV-2. Initial test is usually an RT-PCR from an NP swab, and if the first swab is negative, a second separate NP swab is sent 24 hours after the first test. Blood is also sent for SARS-CoV-2, IgM, and IgG serologic testing. Additional site-specific SARS-CoV-2 testing may be available and could be considered if the initial NP swabs and the blood serologic tests are negative. For example, we have sent out stool for RT-PCR testing to the University of Washington, and lower respiratory tract specimens can also be sent for RT-PCR on intubated patients. For safety reasons, specimens should never be submitted for viral culture. Viral culture is reserved for research purposes. Next slide, please. Detectable antibodies generally take several days to weeks to develop, and the specific median time to antibody detection will vary based on the specific serologic assay that is used. In a study titled Antibody Responses to SARS-CoV-2 in Patients of Novel Coronavirus Disease 2019, published in Clinical Infectious Diseases, the authors found the median time from symptom onset to antibody detection was 12 days for IgM and 14 days for IgG. Next slide, please. Next, I would like to discuss the SARS-CoV-2 testing results in MIS-C patients that are available to date. In the correspondence article from the UK published in The Lancet that Dr. Chu mentioned earlier, none of the 8 patients tested positive initially for SARS-CoV-2 virus on BAL or NP aspirates. However, all 8 patients tested positive for antibody to SARS-CoV-2, either following discharge, as was the case with 7 patients, or with post-mortem testing, as was the case with 1 patient. In terms of viral co-infection, 1 patient also tested positive for adenovirus and enterovirus. Next slide, please. The next published study described 10 cases from the Italian epicenter of the SARS-CoV-2 epidemic. And in this study, 2 out of 10 tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 virus on NP swab, and no patients had identified co-infections. In terms of serologic testing, 2 out of 10 were negative for both IgM and IgG. Half were IgM negative, but IgG positive, and 3 out of 10 were both IgM and IgG positive. Next slide, please. In the next study published in Circulation on May 17th, 35 cases diagnosed with MIS-C and acute heart failure from France and Switzerland were described. In this study, 34% tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 virus on nasal swab, and no patients had identified co-infections. 2 patients tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 by fecal PCR testing. 86% tested positive for antibody to SARS-CoV-2 with various patterns of IgA, IgM, and IgG positivity as outlined here. Results for 5 patients were missing, and approximately a third of patients had a history of a sick contact in the family. Next slide, please. There are also unpublished results which were presented in the CDC Clinical Outreach and Communication Activity Call on May 19th. In this call, 38 cases from the UK were presented with 32% positive by SARS-CoV-2 PCR testing and 50% positive by SARS-CoV-2 IgG testing. 61% of the patients were positive by either method. Notable in this data is that 5 patients were PCR positive and IgG negative, suggestive of a current viral infection rather than post-infectious disease. Next slide, please. Cases from Cohen Children's Medical Center in New York were also presented during the May 19th CDC COCA call. And in their experience, 18% of patients were both IgG and PCR positive, and 73% were IgG positive and PCR negative. Next slide, please. So in summary, patients with MIS-C have various testing results for SARS-CoV-2 virus. Some patients test negative by PCR, antigen, and antibody. Some patients test positive by both PCR and antibody. And some test positive by PCR, but negative by antibody. Some test negative by PCR and positive by antibody with various patterns of IgM and IgG positivity. The majority of cases to date do test positive by antibody. Next slide, please. A clinical therapeutic staging proposal for COVID-19 in adults was published in the Journal of Heart and Lung Transplantation with Figure 1 in the reference provided here. Although the staging for COVID-19 disease in children would likely show a relative lack of stage 2, the pulmonary phase of the disease, I think this graphic shows that there is thought to be a significant overlap between current viral infection and the host inflammatory response phase. There is also a spectrum of timing of presentation for pediatric patients with MIS-C. which is reflected by the differences in diagnostic testing results and in the differences in their presenting symptoms and time course of illness and exposures. Treatment decisions should therefore be individualized and guided by a specific patient's diagnostic evaluation. Antiviral treatment holds the greatest promise if applied during early infection, and if immunosuppressive therapy is applied in patients with active viral infection, it could provoke viral replication and potentially cause more harm than benefit. Next slide, please. Next, I would briefly discuss the infectious differential diagnosis for the rare subset of patients who present with febrile inflammatory shock, who decompensate quickly upon presentation to medical care. We want to be sure to be vigilant and not miss other diagnoses during this pandemic. And we think about streptococcal and staphylococcal toxic shock syndromes, tick-borne illnesses such as Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and secondary HLH as the primary infectious differential diagnoses for patients presenting with shock and concern for MISC. Secondary HLH can be triggered by several viral, bacterial, parasitic, and fungal infections, as you see outlined here. Epstein-Barr virus is one, although it's a rare complication, that is typically associated and linked with secondary HLH. Next slide, please. Given this differential diagnosis, for patients with febrile shock, we send cultures and initiate broad-spectrum antibiotics based on a patient's presentation, which is usually including empiric ceftriaxone. We send additional diagnostic testing for other viral, bacterial, and tick-borne infections, guided by the clinical picture and the epidemiologic risk and exposure history. We also save serum before a patient receives IVIG for possible future diagnostic testing. We also add on a BioFire respiratory pathogen PCR panel for patients once they're admitted to the hospital to evaluate for co-infections, and this is performed on the same NP swab that was sent for the SARS-CoV-2 virus PCR testing. Next slide, please. We do not yet know which treatments are beneficial or harmful for SARS-CoV-2-associated inflammatory conditions, and several children do well with supportive care alone. The role of antiviral therapy in the management of MISC is uncertain, but when decision is made to use antiviral therapy, remdesivir is preferred. Next slide, please. MISC may represent a post-infectious complication rather than active viral disease. However, some children with MISC do have positive PCR and negative serologic testing, suggesting the possibility of a current infection where viral pathogenicity is contributing to the patient's pathology. There is a potential concern for delay of viral clearance or even the risk of provoking viral replication with immunosuppression, and therefore antiviral treatment could be potentially beneficial in patients with evidence of ongoing viral PCR positivity, especially in the setting of severe or refractory or progressive MISC disease. Next slide, please. Remdesivir maintains antiviral activity in coronavirus despite the unique 3' to 5' exoribonuclease of coronaviruses that makes other nucleoside analogs like ribavirin ineffective. Data in children is lacking, but randomized trials and case series in adults do show benefits. Data also suggests it's a very well-tolerated antiviral treatment. On Friday, May 1st, the FDA issued emergency use authorization to treat hospitalized patients with severe COVID-19. The compassionate use portal remains available to pediatric patients through the drug manufacturer. Next slide, please. No children in the published articles from UK or Italy received antiviral treatment. Small numbers of children in New York and Massachusetts have received remdesivir as part of their treatment for severe MISC disease. Consultation with an infectious disease specialist is advised to guide recommendations for antiviral treatment. Thank you very much. I will now turn your attention to Dr. Jane Neuberger.
I can't get unmuted. Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Okay, excellent. Thanks. First slide. Next slide, please. Next slide. So I think you've all, go back one. So I think you've all heard that each of the definitions for this new COVID-19 associated inflammatory syndrome includes the possibility that some individuals will have either incomplete or partial or full criteria for Kawasaki disease. And just to review what that means, KD is really a syndrome, by definition, a fever for at least 5 days and 4 out of 5 criteria that include conjunctival injection, a strawberry tongue and pharyngeal erythema and cracking of the lips, polymorphous exanthem, puffy hands and feet and red palms and soles, and the least common criterion is unilateral cervical adenopathy. Next slide, please. However, despite about 40 years of searching for a pathogen, we have not yet found a single cause of Kawasaki disease, and most people in the field believe there probably are a variety of infectious triggers that cause an immune response in a genetically susceptible host. Next slide, please. We also know that you can fulfill the epidemiologic case definition when you have a coronary artery aneurysm, one or more. You can see right and left coronary aneurysms in the CT scan. So when those are seen on echo or coronary angiography, even if a patient has fewer than 4 out of 5 principal criteria, they can still be considered a KD case. Next slide. And this is a graph that took children from 4 major medical centers who had aneurysms and looked at how many fulfilled the criteria for Kawasaki disease. And you can see that about a third never met the full criteria. And that's why we do treat so many children with suspected incomplete Kawasaki disease. Next slide, please. So how is Kawasaki disease different from MISC? First of all, Kawasaki disease occurs predominantly in early childhood. You can have cases all the way into the teens, but 80% of cases are less than 5 years of age, whereas MISC is distributed so that most kids are older, either early school age through adolescence, although there are some very young babies with C. GI symptoms, as mentioned before, including abdominal pain, diarrhea, vomiting, even reports of colitis, are strikingly prominent in MISC. Third, the MISC patients generally have a greater degree of cytokine storm, and they have a lab profile with very high CRPs, and compared to KD patients, higher D-dimers, higher ferritin, higher troponin, and either BNP or N-terminal pro-BNP. They also have lower platelets, strikingly lower platelets, and a strikingly lower absolute lymphocyte count at presentation. And then finally, MISC patients are more likely to present with shock and with low left ventricular ejection fraction. Next slide, please. So some of the greatest confusion comes when somebody comes in with Kawasaki shock syndrome. We call it Kawasaki sometimes. And the children really have almost a septic shock or toxic shock picture when they come in with distributive shock. These kids do have severe GI symptoms, and they have many of the same lab findings, although, again, not quite as severe as we see in the MISC patients. 31% have low left ventricular ejection fraction, and 40% have more than mild mitral regurgitation. This is a group that has a higher risk of coronary artery aneurysms. They have a higher troponin or cardiac enzymes than children with other forms of Kawasaki disease, and they also are more likely to be IVIG resistant. They usually recover very quickly with IVIG. Next slide. Next. So what about coronary arteries in MISC? Because the doomsday scenario is that these children will be left with some of the long-term life-threatening sequelae that Kawasaki disease children can have. So children with MISC have been reported in the literature to have coronary dilation and more rarely aneurysms. But there's some caveats. Coronary dimensions adjusted for body surface area are based on values in children without fever. So they're afebrile norms. And we know that children with fever have more dilated coronary arteries than those without fever. And the studies on febrile children have not been nearly as inflamed as they are in MISC. And then finally, coronary aneurysms can occur in illnesses other than Kawasaki disease. So there are other kinds of inflammatory and infectious diseases that can cause this. Next, it's important to realize the series that have been reported that our other speakers have spoken about vary considerably in their report of aneurysms. So in the series from France and Switzerland of Bell Hadgers that was in circulation recently, not one of 35 patients, all of whom were admitted pretty much with shock and low cardiac output to intensive care units, none had an aneurysm. There were 2 of 10 patients in the Bergamo series and 1 of 8 in the series from London. None of the studies had standard definitions or core lab readings. And so we have a long, long way to go of needing systematic follow-up of these patients to better understand their hearts and the long-term sequelae. Next slide, please. And then last, for the pediatricians in the audience, it's important to recognize that we are probably seeing a spectrum of SARS-CoV-2 immune-mediated syndromes. You have SARS-CoV-2 triggered shock, and some of the series have concentrated on that. And some seem to have a little bit of a less mild illness where children are on our wards, where they look like they have Kawasaki disease, maybe a different lab profile. But out in the community, we are hearing stories of many, many children who have persistent fever and aren't as sick but are having a variety of symptoms. And so I would make a plea at this point that we all come together as a field and get as many laboratory samples as we can in children, and also be sure that everybody is in a registry that is commonly accessible. Thank you very much.
Okay, can you hear me? Okay, thank you. Next slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about the hyperinflammation that we are seeing in these MISC children. Most of the ones that we have admitted here at our hospital have quite a bit of inflammation, and the ones that are doing less well have much higher levels of some of the markers that we're following. It became clear early in the adult experience that critically ill adults were developing signs of what we call a cytokine storm in response to infection with COVID-19. These adults had very high fevers and frequently ARDS. They were often extremely ill, ending up in the ICU and on ventilators. And people started to notice that this tended to occur a little later in the course of disease after a shorter period of time where the disease seemed more mild. Findings when they looked at laboratory testing in these patients included very highly elevated C-reactive proteins, elevated ferritins, and elevated D-dimers, as well as cytopenias, particularly in platelets and in lymphocytes, and many elevated cytokines, including IL-1, IL-6, IL-12, IL-2 receptors, TNF. Some of the findings, particularly with the elevated IL-6 levels in these patients, led to therapeutic interventions in the adults. The most well-publicized is probably tocilizumab. Also, another IL-6 agent, sarilumab, has been trialed in some of these adult patients to try to inhibit the IL-6-mediated signal. Next slide. As you probably realize, a lot of the findings in these people are consistent with hemophagocytic lymphocytic histiocytosis, or HLH. HLH is a sort of broad term that encompasses both the genetic HLH and also secondary HLH that can come from viruses and infections, as Dr. Murray mentioned earlier. the diagnostic guidelines for HLH from the 2004 set include persistent fever, splenomegaly, cytopenias, particularly hemoglobin, platelets, and neutrophils, hypertriglyceridemia and hypofibrinogenemia, high ferritins, greater than 500 in the criteria, but they frequently are significantly higher than that, increased soluble IL-2 receptor activity, and low NK cell activity, and biopsy showing hemophagocytosis. Obviously, not every patient has all of these findings, but these are the guidelines that are looked at. Next slide. In pediatric rheumatology, over the last 20 years, we've become more in tune with something called macrophage activation syndrome, which bears significant similarities to HLH, but occurs in the setting of children that have underlying rheumatic disease. It's life-threatening with multi-organ involvement and is one of the more severe sequelae that can happen in these children. It happens most frequently in systemic JIA, but it can occur in Kawasaki's disease, lupus, and dermatomyositis. It is thought to be due to excessive activation and expansion of T cells and macrophages, which leads to this overwhelming inflammatory reaction and release of the pro-inflammatory cytokines. And just like in Kawasaki's, we do not know why some children are more prone to this than others. It can happen early in the disease as they are being diagnosed, but there are also patients that are diagnosed later in the disease on treatment. There have been reports of patients on tocilizumab that develop MAS symptoms while they're being treated. Estimates in systemic JIA, which is a very highly inflammatory disease, are that about 10% of patients can have severe MAS, but that probably 30 to 40% of patients may have milder forms of activation. As noted, the manifestations are similar, with lymphadenopathy, fever, and organomegaly. The pancytopenias and ferritins are elevated. In MAS patients, the ferritin can be extremely high. We often see them in the 5,000 to 10,000 range, and there's very few things in children that cause ferritins at that high of a level. One of the difficulties is recognizing when your patient has MAS, because most of the diseases with which this is associated are highly inflammatory in the first place. So patients with systemic JIA often have elevated ferritins and D-dimers at baseline. Some of the clues that we think about is that patients with systemic arthritis and other inflammation issues also tend to have high platelets and high white blood cell counts. So the finding of an increase in D-dimers and ferritin in the setting of falling platelets and falling blood cell counts is suspicious for developing MAS. And one of the other striking findings is that these patients often have a very highly elevated CRP, perhaps 100 to 200, with a disproportionately low or even falling ESR. So a patient might have a CRP of 200 and a SED rate of 25, which is not what you would expect to see in an actively infected patient or in a patient with a rheumatologic flare. Next slide. These are some classification criteria that were made for MAS. In brief, you have a fever and you have systemic JIA. The green things are the elevated things, and the red things are the low things. So you have elevated ferritin, AST, and triglycerides, and you have low fibrinogen and platelets. And these were some criteria to help rheumatologists try to assess which patients are at risk for continuing to severe dysfunction. Next slide. MISC, as you've already heard, there are different subgroups of patients, and the patients that we have admitted here fall into a lot all of these different categories. There are some that seem like classic Kawasaki's, some that are atypical Kawasaki's, some that are more shock-like, and some that seem to have more MAS features. As already was emphasized, pulmonary features are not prominent in any of these children. Some of the patients, but not all of the patients, have evidence of MAS on admission or that develops while they've been in the hospital. They have the increased ferritin, although not generally as high as we see in MAS. It tends to be between 500 and 1,000 in many of the children. They do have very high CRPs, often above 100 and sometimes over 200. Liver function tests are generally elevated, and the D-dimers tend to run in the thousands. Low numbers of lymphocytes and the hyponatremia have been very helpful in identifying some of these patients, as have the dropping platelet numbers. We do sometimes send cytokine levels like IL-2 receptor antagonists and IL-6, but unfortunately these do not generally come back soon enough to really help us with treatment decisions. Next slide. As was emphasized, some of these patients just are observed. Some of them are treated as Kawasaki's. More severe Kawasaki's type patients are treated as a resistant Kawasaki's with more IVIG, perhaps infliximab, perhaps cyclosporin. And then the patients that do have features suggestive of MAS may require stronger immunosuppressive therapy, particularly steroid therapy or even biologic therapy. Targets that have been mentioned for biologic therapy are IL-1, anakinra, and canakinumab, IL-6, tocilizumab and sarilumab, JAK inhibitors such as ruxolitinib and tofacitinib, and TNF inhibitors. Next slide. I'll mention just two of them. Tocilizumab, which people have heard a lot about, is approved in children for treatment of polyarticular juvenile arthritis, systemic arthritis. It is used in adults for rheumatoid arthritis and CAR T cell-induced cytokine storm, so there is a good experience using tocilizumab. Generally in the hospital, it's given as an IV agent monthly, but it can be given subcutaneously more frequently. It has shown promise in adult patients with ARDS and cytokine storm with COVID-19, and trials are ongoing, as they are for Kepcera, which is the other IL-6 agent. Next slide. We have chosen here to use anakinra more frequently as the first-line treatment prior to tocilizumab for the children that have MISC. Anakinra is a recombinant humanized IL-1 receptor antagonist. We have a lot of experience using it. It is approved for rheumatoid arthritis, systemic arthritis, and some of the periodic fever syndromes. And it has been used in rheumatology to treat MAS in the past in some of the rheumatologic patients. It is a short-acting medication with only a 4 to 6 hour half-life, which makes it attractive for using in patients. It comes in 100 milligram aliquots, so we try to balance the dosing so that we do not waste the drug. It can be safely given IV, which we tend to do in the ICU, or if it is needing to be given more frequently than daily or twice daily. One of the other advantages is that there's a broad range of therapeutic doses. We can dose patients anywhere between 2 and 10 milligrams per kilo per day, and sometimes even higher than that. The advantages of anakinra over something like tocilizumab are mostly because of the short half-life. It is less myelosuppressive because it goes out of your system more quickly. It tends to be less hepatotoxic, although we did have one patient who probably did develop some hepatotoxicity on the anakinra. But the much shorter half-life allows us to balance risks of infection worries in the patient, and we can withdraw the treatment easily if we need to. And last slide, I think. So considerations, we do not know when patients come in who really needs this type of escalated therapy. Certainly patients in the ICU or headed towards ECMO tend to get all of these types of medications thrown at them. Patients who are admitted and seem less sick, but who have continued fevers and increasing inflammatory markers, particularly in the setting of dropping cell counts and a normal SED rate, would be patients we would watch very carefully. It is a balancing act between the risks of active infection, as Dr. Murray was saying, and the risks of the hyperinflammation itself. We have an interdisciplinary team here that's been very helpful of rheumatology, infectious disease, and cardiology that talks about all of these patients every day to try to figure out the best way to treat each of them in an individualized way. Thank you.
Dr. Lahoud Rama, if you can come off mute for us. You try and tap on the lower left part of your screen. Still not doing it. Just bear with what we'll do while you're working on the mute. If you click on the screen when the menu comes up down left, there are a couple of questions that we'll answer that have been submitted so far. I'll start with Dr. Chu. There was a question about some of the previous literature that you cited, that there is a wide range of antibody sensitivity among tests that we know. And what can you comment about the sensitivity of the antibody tests in detecting illness in the literature that you cited?
Okay.
I see you on Dr. Chu's screen.
Hi. The host is still unmuting me. That's why I couldn't get on. So if he can unmute me, and then Joanne will take her seat back.
Great. We will try again. I think you just have to accept the unmute on your screen, or you can just...
All right, I'm sorry, guys. It's my honor to be Joanne for a few moments. I want to share with you the tale of two patients. The first one we presented, and Dr. Chu had talked about, before we knew about this multi-inflammatory syndrome. And then I'll share with you the other patient who really presented in shock. So a 10-year-old, previously healthy child presented with a history of 7 days of fever, fatigue, and abdominal pain, mainly diffuse pain with diarrhea and vomiting, and came to our ER. He was evaluated previously at an outside hospital and had a nasal swab that was negative for SARS-CoV-2. He was sent home with supportive therapy. And then, as his symptoms worsened, he continued to have a fever, dry cough, and then developed conjunctivitis and rash. So his mother called the pediatrician, who sent her to the ER to rule out Kawasaki. When he arrived, he was mainly, he was hemodynamically stable, but febrile, maybe soft blood pressures, but really sitting well on room air. He looked fatigued, but non-toxic. He was talking in full sentences, and really no other focal signs except the conjunctivitis and the rash. He was made to march in place just to see if his saturations drop when he was more active. Actually, he became lightheaded, his heart rate increased, but his SAFs were stable. Next. As you can see, he has the lymph-sparing conjunctivitis, and he has this rash all over his body except the palms and the soles of his feet. Next. Because our emergency room has been taking care of a lot of adults with COVID-19, he got the slew of labs that you wouldn't really necessarily get in your ER. His chest x-ray was really unremarkable. He did not have cardiomegaly. His lungs were really without any focal opacities, just some fluid in the fissure. His ECG showed sinus tachycardia with small axial voltages, or without any ischemic changes. His white count was high with predominant of neutrophils. He was not anemic. However, his electrolytes were off. His sodium was low. His CRP was extremely high. His troponins came back a little bit elevated, and his ferritin, LDH, fibrinogen, and D-dimer were all elevated. Next.
Since he arrived, he actually got ibuprofen and a saline bolus, as we all do when someone is tachycardic. He remained tachy, his temperature dropped. Dr. Murray was called, and she recommended ceftriaxone and doxycycline. We set the BioFire strep cultures and EBV titers. However, he started becoming hypotensive despite defervescence, and he remained tachycardic. 4 hours into his arrival, his COVID PCR resulted as positive. And when the team was reviewing all the labs, they noticed the troponin. So our cardiologist was called, Dr. Chu. She requested proBNP because he looked so good. And the proBNP came back at 9,477, so markedly elevated. This prompted a point-of-care ultrasound by our ER team. Next. On the right side, you see this picture. In the center, you see a circle. It looks like a donut. This is the left ventricle. This is short axis view of the LV. And on top, there's like a crescent-like that is the RV. The function was severely depressed. The LV was not squeezing well and thickening. It was mainly rocking. On the left side of your screen, you see it's a kind of a modified parasternal long axis view where you see the left atrium, the left ventricle and the septum and a part of the RV, and you see that the function is really not the greatest. Next slide, next. So when the ultrasound was being done, the cardiologist arrived and they actually and noticed that the blood pressure was actually trending down. He was tachycardic without any arrhythmias. The patient was still asymptomatic. He looked good. He was talking. He did not have any symptoms. He had a Gallop on his exam, but still no hepatosplenomegaly, still clear lungs, but his cap refill was delayed and his peripheral pulses were diminished. So he was started on inotropic support. Next. At that time, our pediatric ICU was only taking care of adult COVID patients. He was transferred to an outside hospital for a higher level of care. Next. So he was admitted, and an echocardiogram, a full echocardiogram, showed that his EF was 30%. Typically, it should be above 55. While he was on epi and norepi, however, was treated with inotropic support, remdesivir, anakinra, steroids, IVIG, and aspirin. He luckily slowly improved, never intubated, and his function recovered. He interestingly developed a transient AV block, but he did not need a pacemaker, and he was discharged home. He's on weaning steroids diuretics with improved function. So after that case, we kind of got alarmed and we started hearing from all over the world about those patients presenting like him. We recently had another case that I would like to share with you if we have time. The second patient is an 8-year-old who presented with 6 days of fever. On day of two of illness, he tested negative for COVID. But then he slowly developed a rash, then emesis, watery diarrhea, and progressively had increased work of breathing and fatigue, which prompted his grandfather, who is his legal guardian, to bring him to an outside hospital. In the ER, he was tachycardic, but not so much febrile. His blood pressures were fine. However, in triage, he had a systolic blood pressure of 86. He was tachypneic, but with the full saturations. This patient looked unwell. He was tachypneic, initially without retractions, but then within 45 minutes, he became febrile, and he started having more retractions. He had some conjunctival erythema, he had a rash, and he had signs of shock with delayed cap refill and thready pulses. He became also agitated with fever and more hypotensive despite fluid resuscitation by the ER team. A point of care ultrasound showed RV dilation and dysfunction and IVC plethora. So he was intubated. I want to share with you his initial workup before he was intubated. Next. So his chest X-ray, as you notice, is really unremarkable. And this is what we've been seeing. The cardiac silhouette might be a little bit borderline enlarged. However, the lungs are really not wet. And this is because patients who are sick present with poor PO intake, and they are dehydrated. So they're not really, their liver is not big. They don't have a lot of pulmonary edema. However, you give them a little bit of fluid, and they just go into pulmonary edema. This guy's ancillary testing was remarkable for an elevated white blood cell count, also low sodium and chloride, high creatinine, and high LFTs with low albumin. His CRP was markedly elevated. His initial gas was okay. His troponins were elevated. High sensitivity troponin normal is less than 14 with elevated LDH, fibrinogen, D-dimer. And he also tested positive for COVID PCR. So when his work of breathing worsened, the team got a VBG and showed marked acidemia with a pH of 7.05. So he was intubated, started on epinephrine, and was airlifted to our institution. Next. We were ready for him to be on mechanical support because the EMT were escalating epinephrine. Before he was placed on ECMO, his echocardiogram showed severe LV dysfunction. So on the right side of your screen, you will see that the LV is dilated. It looks like a donut. Yes, thank you. And it's really not breathing well. It's actually rocking. The right ventricle is also not working very well. On the left side, we have an apical four-chamber view where the left side of your screen is the left atrium, left ventricle. The squeeze is very poor. The ejection fraction was 14%. There was severe mitral regurgitation. The origins of the coronaries were normal. However, the left main and the LAD were dilated mildly. So, next. He was cannulated on ECMO and tolerated that very well. His function improved. We threw the book at him, which with remdesivir, IVIG, anakinra, steroids, and he was anticoagulated. It only took 4 days for his function to recover. We decannulated him on day 5, and he was extubated the next day. He actually is doing really well in the hospital, just waiting for a placement in rehab just because he developed ICU myopathy. Next. Thus far, we have admitted 8 patients. We reported 8 patients, but we have admitted more. And some of the patients have symptoms compatible with MISC. But we're still waiting serology to confirm them and report them. The clinical presentation ranges from fever and warm shock with normal function to Kawasaki-like illness with features of MAS and normal echocardiogram or Kawasaki syndrome. It could be a combination of any. But we also have seen a rise in patients with Kawasaki disease not related to COVID, which is interesting. Next. So after our first case, we kind of noticed that there is the syndrome that we need to make all the pediatrician be aware. So we kind of got some guidelines, and those are based also on the CDC advisory. If the pediatrician sees someone who meets criteria, we ask them to get some labs just to see how the inflammation markers are. And if available, we ask them to do more. Next. The pediatrician actually have been, the pediatrician affiliated to MGH and partners have been really good at kind of getting those labs and calling us for advice. This includes the pediatric cardiology, infectious disease, and rheumatology. Next. I would like to leave you with final consideration. MISC is a rare condition. In New York, 160 out of 10,000 children developed it as of last Saturday. And in Italy, 1 out of 1,000 of kids exposed got PIMS, or I'm sorry, MISC. Some patients may be negative for SARS-CoV-2 with PCR, but the antigen and serology testing can be positive or even negative. The predominant symptoms are fever and GI symptoms. They can be well appearing, but have concerning vital signs. And that's why when they present to the ER, we need you to be aware that please use very little fluids because a lot of fluids can tip them over the edge. And however, when they present critically ill, they respond to treatment and supportive care, and they really go on to do very well. As everybody, I echo what everybody said, we need national and international collaboration to understand this disease, treat it, and develop guidelines. And my last slide, I would leave you with the public health reporting and information about that. I know that every state is mandates reporting, but in Massachusetts, this is our contact, Dr. Sue. If you have any questions to report or for reporting purposes, thank you so much.
So thank you so much to our fantastic presenters. I want to thank Dr. Chu, Dr. Murray, Dr. Neuberger, Dr. Rothermel, and Dr. Lahoud-Ram for really a fantastic presentation here, representing two of the tertiary care centers that are really doing phenomenal work with pediatric patients with this new syndrome. Obviously, as was just mentioned, reporting is individual to each of the New England states, and so certainly we want clinicians in their respective state to work with their public health department to report these cases. We did see a bunch of questions come by in the chat. We will do our best to answer those questions and try and post them with this webinar as well as with the slides. The webinar will be available recorded on our website for the Regional Disaster Health Response System. That's www.rdhrs.org. So rdhrs.org. And we want to thank you all very, very much for your presentation. Thanks again to our fantastic panelists. And we wish you all the very best. Thank you so much.